Welcome to Barbara London Calling 2.0. I'm your host, Barbara London. In 1974, I founded the Video Media Program at the Museum of Modern Art, where I was a curator for 40 years. Today, with technology as ubiquitous and as fluid as water, I'm interested in how artists adapt technology to their own artistic language and vision. In season two of Barbara London Calling, I'm speaking with 12 artists from all over the world, each challenging the entrenched definitions of what art is and what it can be. Welcome to Barbara London Calling 2.0. Well, my guest today is the acclaimed artist and inspired thinker, Lorraine O'Grady. During her career, Lorraine has engaged in a range of disciplines from performance and dance to photography, writing, and the moving image, all while investigating the politics of diaspora and identity. Born in Boston in 1934 to Caribbean immigrant parents, Lorraine served as an intelligence analyst for the U.S. government, moved on to become a literary and commercial translator, then a rock music critic, before she turned to visual arts in the late 1970s. Welcome, Lorraine. I'm delighted to speak with you today.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
So let's start with your art practice as it evolved in the late 70s. Tell me a little bit about arriving in New York and those formative years. I know you were a vigilant volunteer at the just above Midtown Gallery in Manhattan. And I'm curious, what was the atmosphere there like at the time? You had artists like David Hammons coming by, and the prescient gallery director, Linda Good Bryant, was pretty astute. So what was that like?
It was really wonderful, but you couldn't say that it was perfect because the gallery felt like a gallery living in sort of a kind of isolation because it was a gallery basically devoted to the black avant-garde, and the white and the black art worlds were totally separate at that time. There was a pretty rigid system, conscious or unconscious, of segregation in the art world. So the thing about the gallery was that it had become the whole art world for the people who were there. When they weren't working in their studios, they were coming down to the gallery to just hang out for their social life and to talk about art. So the conversations, even as the gallery was setting up a new gallery on Franklin Street from the ground up, people would be helping with the scraping and the painting. When they were not in their studios, they would be hanging out in the front talking. And then there was a outdoor restaurant bar down the street that they'd be drinking white wine spritzers in. And the talk was always excited and always about art. And I think that, you know, some people were keeping up with the white art world. Others didn't care about the white art world. There was a sense that the really important art world was what was happening at JAM, just above Midtown. That made it a very exciting place to be, really.
I want to turn to your performance, Mademoiselle Bourgeoisie Noire, which in French means Miss Black Middle Class. And I think it maybe evolved out of that experience at JAM. So I believe you had a photographer in tow. You arrived uninvited to the 1980 opening of the new museum's Persona exhibition.
Can I interrupt you there just for 1 second?
Sure.
And that is that I did not have a photographer in tow when I did it at just above Midtown. I was pretty naive. I was really just starting out. I didn't even realize that you needed to have your work documented, you know. But then I realized after the performance that there was a one image shot at the night of the performance that appeared in the Soho Weekly News. And it really didn't have anything to do with my idea of the performance. And so I realized I better get something down on record. And I went back 2 days later to an empty gallery to try to reperform what I had done. And that didn't work either. So the first time that I actually documented that performance was a year later when I did it at the New Museum.
So when you went to the New Museum, to the Persona exhibition, the museum was, I think, only 3 years old at that moment. And I really love the images that I've seen. You wore a white ball gown made from 180 pairs of white gloves that you bought at local thrift stores, and you carried a cat of nine tails made of sail rope studded with white chrysanthemums. So to me, it was like you were a beauty queen. You wore a beauty pageant-like sash with the words Mademoiselle Bourgeoisie Noire. And you, in the photo documentation, you're glamorous and you just have this wonderful, radiant smile, even though the work referenced quite weighty topics such as slavery and servitude. So I'd love to know a little more about the work. And also, I read afterwards that you felt disappointed about the performance. I wonder why.
Well, actually, the documentation accurately that I got that night actually was pretty accurate in portraying the many different moods that I went in. I wasn't always smiling radiantly. In order to do that performance, I had to employ a variety of emotions. And I would say that the most typical was a sort of going back and forth between, you know, almost violent anger at the situation that I was there to protest, and sort of joy and elation at the very act of performing and having friends out in the audience and so forth. So it was a combination of joy and anger that enabled me and was present in the performance. But what happened next was that only one image of the performance became circulated, and that was one of me very angry, screaming out my poem. So for almost 30 years, I would say, the performance and people's knowledge of it was the prisoner of this single image of me shouting that had sort of become an empty signifier. So one of the wonderful things that's happened since then is that I've been able, through the website and other things, to give the full impression, which is the one that you seem to have received. So I'm very happy about that. But the evening of the performance, I would say nobody was expecting me, and they thought I must be part of the show. So there was a kind of sort of gradual awareness as the performance continued that I was not part of the show, and that there were some people who were pretty angry. What is this person doing here who doesn't even belong here? And then there were other people who were just so blown away, enamored by the beauty of the performance and the energy of the performance, that they were beginning to participate, you know, from the sidelines. So it was a combination of reactions that took place there. When I did the performance at just above Midtown, I had a poem that ended with a punchline, "Black art must take more risks." And after I beat myself with the Whip That Made Plantations move at the New Museum, I shouted out a poem, and the punchline there at the New Museum was, "Now is the time for an invasion." It was actually, the punchline was actually still being addressed to Black artists, to not be timid, not to accept this situation of segregation, but to take active steps to protest, you know, to start proceeding less from a standpoint of playing it safe and trying to just do good work, but taking a more activist stance was what I was calling for, I think.
The show was called Persona, and it featured the work of white artists.
Yes, it had. I used ended up by calling it the Nine White Persona Show, and it was sort of insulting because they had asked me to do the outreach. They knew about Mademoiselle Bourgeoisie, but they asked me to do the outreach to the school children. And so I told the director of education who had contacted me, well, why don't we wait until after the opening? And then something pretty terrible happened. After the opening, I got a typed letter from him saying that I was disinvited from doing the outreach. It was a different time, and I don't think people had a way exactly of parsing out all of what was actually going on in the performance, or why the performance was being made, or anything like that.
Just a few years later, you created in 1983 a performance called Art Is. And that was a very community-oriented event that you carried out at the African American Day Parade in Harlem. You created a 9-by-15-foot antique-style gold frame, and you mounted it on a gold-skirted float, which slowly traveled up Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard, framing everything it passed as art. And you had, I think, 15 young actors and dancers dressed in white, each holding a gold picture frame, and they then framed individual viewers there, and there were all these shouts, frame me, make me art. So do you want to say something? I guess the impetus behind the performance was you're answering a challenge, which is pretty a stiff challenge, made by a Narn artist acquaintance who said to you, avant-garde art doesn't have anything to do with Black people.
Well, yeah, you know, you'd asked a question before, like feeling that the Mademoiselle Bourdonnoir was disappointing. Why did I feel that? You know, I had come to the point where I realized that just shouting out these poems wasn't going to do it. It wasn't going to change anything. And it really did. It was a way of stating what the problem was, but I needed to go further than just stating the problem. I had to provide answers for the problem. So the first thing that I did as Mademoiselle Bourdonnoir, you know, she became an impresario. So she curated a show at Kinkelaba Gallery, which was a Black-owned gallery in the East Village. And that show was called the Black and White Show. And it was 14 white artists and 14 Black artists, and all the work was in Black and White. And I thought that this would be that holding the color of the work still, stabilizing that, and giving an equal number of Black and White artists in the show, that a conversation might be able to happen on the walls that I had never seen in the white art world. And actually, you know, Whitney Biennial was that year, and only three people of color were in the biennial that year, including Jean-Michel Basquiat. And for the 1983 biennial, with all of the energy and all of the wonderful artists at Just Above Midtown, not a single one, including David Hammons, had received a studio visit for the biennial. So I was putting on something like, you know, 3 weeks after the biennial closed, which was a kind of like my own biennial, you know. Well, it didn't work that well, I would say, because it only got like a half paragraph review in the East Village Other. But a few months after that, Mademoiselle Bourdonnoir went out again in a different way. You know, the first performance had said, this is what the situation is. And the second performance had said, these are who the artists should be. And now I went to Harlem with the artist performance in order to say, this is who the audience should be. It was a very frightening performance for me to do because I didn't know Harlem that very well at all. I really, because I'm West Indian, I was very familiar with Brooklyn and the community of West Indian immigrants there, but I didn't really know Harlem. And I didn't know whether these performance would work. The only way I had of communicating with this million or so people that were on the parade route, I mean, it's really amazing when you think about it, a million people. The only way I had of communicating with them was I wrote on the side paper of the float, art is ... on both sides. And so the performance could work, it could not have worked. But after a while, I began hearing these shouts, that's right, that's what art is, we're the art. And then frame me, make me art. And I just couldn't believe my ears. It was working better than I ever could have imagined. And I thought that performance was a successful venture of Mademoiselle Bourdonnoir. Had sort of emerged from this ethos of playing it safe and putting your head down and just doing what had to be done, right? You know, I emerged from that with, let's not just do what has to be done or play it safe. Let's go out there and make a revolution. But it was just wonderful to see the response of the people to the float and the young people framing them with small frames.
So you just had an amazing show at the Brooklyn Museum, a kind of retrospective. That's Lorraine O'Grady, both and. But when I saw your photographic work, Miscegenated Family Album, which has the dates 1980-1994, I loved how it was so unpretentiously installed in the Brooklyn Museum's Egyptian galleries. So the Miscegenated Family Album has 16 Cibachrome diptychs, So the diptychs evolved out of your 1980 performance of Mourning and Reconciliation. One of the pairs was comparing your sister and Nefertiti and their families. And that was projected behind your live action. So you retired the performance in 1988 because you said it felt emotionally and theoretically redundant. But for me, your work, all of your work there in the museum made the museum come alive. And so maybe you could tell me about the juxtapositions and your choice of the location for this family album.
Well, yeah, you know, all of my work is very overdetermined. So there were many different motivations in making the performance. And one of them was a simple one, which was really to reconcile my relationship with my sister, who had died several years earlier. And in order to effect a sort of like ritualized reconciliation with my sister, I had been in Egypt shortly after she died, and going across this square, the largest square and the most well-placed square in Cairo, which is the one that's now called Tahrir Square, you know, the Freedom Square, I was crossing that, and I had just come from an appointment at the U.S. Embassy. I was still sort of like technically employed by the U.S. government, and I had checked in at the embassy. And I was leaving there to go get some American Express traveler's checks in the Hilton on the other side of the square. And as I crossed the square, it was the first time I found myself completely surrounded by people who looked like me. You know, this was something that had not happened in Boston, where there was a very small Black population, and it had not happened in New York, in Harlem. It was the first time that I was surrounded by people who definitely, to me, all looked mixed race. And then I went down into the basement of the Hilton, where they had the American Express office, and the young Egyptian people behind the counter all started speaking to me in Arabic. And when I and when I said, "I'm sorry, but I don't speak Arabic," there was a young woman teller who said to the other tellers, "Oh, she's such a snob. She doesn't speak Arabic." So I came back from that, and I sort of became an amateur Egyptologist. And when I discovered the Amarna period of Nefertiti and her husband Akhenaten, Akhenaten is the one who is the first monotheist, right? He had broken from the official Egyptian religion to sort of found his own monotheistic religion. And they had gone to this place outside in the desert and built an incredible city there. And this was the city that was excavated by the German archaeological team. And they uncovered the sculptor's studio with all of these magnificent, very realistic sculptures, one of which, you know, is the famous sculpture in Berlin of Nefertiti. When I saw this work, and I learned more about the situation of Nefertiti, I discovered that Nefertiti had a younger sister, 6 years younger than she was, whose name was Nejmet, or at least that's what she called at the time I was making the performance. I think they since discovered that her sister had a different name. But Nefertiti was the elder of two sisters, and I was the younger of two sisters. I was 11 years younger than my sister Devonia, and it had always been friction and separation between us. And we had not really sort of reconciled our relationship when she died. And so I was able to use the relationship between Nefertiti and Nejmet as a way of understanding more deeply my own relationship with Devonia. And so that was the primary personal reason for making the performance. But the other important reason was to establish what I felt was something that Egyptology as a whole was resolutely willing itself not to see. And that was that Egypt was a hybrid country. It wasn't just a Middle Eastern country. It was a Middle Eastern / African country. I didn't see how you could understand Egyptian culture without understanding its roots in the South, in Nubia and elsewhere. And so everything that we know about Egypt as Egypt, the pyramids, the hieroglyphs, the nature of kingship, the nature of the religion, all of these things had been established and were completely congruent with the country south of Egypt. And so I felt that Egypt had not really become its fullest self until the South conquered the North, the white North. The black South conquered the white North and combined it into a single country. And when that happened, I think that that's when Egypt really began to flourish as a civilization, but as a hybrid civilization. And for me, ancient Egypt always represented the only one of two hybrid civilizations that I personally know about, and that was ancient Egypt and Al-Andalus, which was the culture, the state that was imposed on Spain by the Moors of North Africa. In Spain, every position in the university was held by whoever was the expert on the topic, whether they were Christian and Spanish or whether they were Arabic and Moorish. And it was just a brilliant hybrid culture. And I felt that these two examples were things that I wanted to promote. But unfortunately, the Egyptology was not ready for me. And I was doing this performance perhaps 8 or 9 years before Martin Bernal did the first volume of his four-volume book, which proved that the influence of Egypt on ancient Greece. The quartet of books was called Black Athena, but that had not happened yet. And so I had nothing but resistance. And basically, I'd be honest with you, nothing but resistance from Egyptology for, you know, 3 decades afterwards. And so for me, I would say that in my retrospective, perhaps for me, the biggest victory was seeing, not just seeing Miscegenated Family Album hung in the Egyptian galleries, but actually a wall text on that I didn't write, but that the curators of the Egyptian department wrote, that in fact, Egyptology had sort of almost willfully refused for centuries to acknowledge the Africanicity of ancient Egypt. That was just, for me, to see it there in a changed environment with a changed attitude by Egyptology itself now to accommodate my ideas. That was the biggest victory for me.
That was fantastic. So, so incredible. And when I came around the corner from the Miscegenated Family and saw landscape in bracket Western Hemisphere, I was really struck by this abstract kind of Monet water lily size projection. And what it was this close-up of your gently rustling, dramatically lit hair. I gather you had fans and you had wonderful natural sounds that came out of nature, whether that was cicadas and whatever. It's a very, very beautiful work. And, you know, I first looked at it and I thought, what is that? But of course, it's your hair. And you told me there's a connection to hall walls and a young woman who was the curator. Is that right?
Yes, actually, I made Landscape Western Hemisphere, the video that you're talking about, as a way of deepening and broadening and giving the viewers a deepened and broadened understanding of a diptych that I had made earlier in a body of work that I call Body is the Ground of My Experience. And there's a diptych in that series called The Clearing. And there was a lot of misunderstanding about The Clearing because The Clearing had in the left-hand panel of it, there was a mixed-race couple, a black female and a white male, making love above the trees. They were floating above the trees, and down on the ground below them, their mixed-race children were playing. And then in the right panel, the scene has changed, and sort of down on the ground, I told the black female model to look bored, and she did. And she was lying on the ground naked, and above her was the same young white man, but now he was wearing a very tattered outfit of chainmail, and he was just grasping her breast very proprietarily. I put him in chainmail because I thought that this relationship, which I feel is the founding relationship of the Western Hemisphere, I sort of had to rename The Clearing in order to make it more clear what I was talking about. And when I did, I called it The Clearing, colon, or Cortés and La Malinche, Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings and me, meaning Anne for any name and myself. And this interrelationship, I felt, was what made America America, not just phenotypically or even primarily phenotypically, but culturally. But I felt that this relationship also had a very dark side, which was that it was the relationship that ended courtly love. Because as this relationship was taking place, of course, on every plantation in the South, there was a white woman who was getting angrier and angrier at what was going on around her and unwilling to recognize that it wasn't just happening on other people's plantations, it was happening on her own. So for me, the relationship had this both bright side and dark side. And the dark side was, I felt, the end of courtly love, as I said. But when I put it on the wall without explaining all of that, most people thought it was a before and after. You know, they said, well, is this the before and after of this relationship? And I said, no, it's the simultaneous piece. It's the both end of this kind of relationship is both always ecstasy and exploitation, and probably of any relationship that you can think of, both of those things combined. But in this place, more severely, more extremely. So I had to rename the piece with the names of these historic figures. I wasn't happy at having done that, and I thought it was rather reductive. And so I wanted to make a piece about the complexities of this relationship now by using my hair, which is very mixed race hair. And, you know, it was wonderful because it worked better than I thought it would work, because I'd put a lot of hair products on my hair and whatnot. So my hair was very glossy and silky when we started the filming. And by the end of 8 hours of shooting, it had all dried out and it looked like tumbleweed, you know. So I had footage to work with in that film, which went between looking like silk and looking like, you know, dried out tumbleweed. I thought that was very much a symbolic reconciliation, but in a very naturalistic way.
So, Lorraine, I learned a lot about your practice by watching a 10-minute video in your work looking for a headdress. And you made it for the 2015 exhibition En Masse at the Contemporary Arts Center in New Orleans, circulated by Independent Curators International. It's full of information, but in the video, you sit in your West Beth studio with Andil Gosin, an Indo-Canadian Trinidadian, a professor of sociology and gender studies. So you both are watching old YouTube videos of Brazilian carnivals and recent footage of the Brooklyn West Indian American Day Parade. So I gather at the time you were developing a new character, kind of avatar of your very iconic Mademoiselle Bourgeoisie Noire. So the outfit for this new persona combined a Western garment and a carnival headdress. And I gather you looked through very traditional ones, but you ended up, I think, with a palm tree. But anyway, I was fascinated how you situated the installation. Viewer sat down at a desk with a computer and monitor, and participated in your research that you were doing by just clicking and moving through. So do you want to talk about your intention with engaging the viewer that way?
I really did go on a search for headdress. The armor that I wanted to wear was the armor of a very late stage of armory, late 16th, early 17th century, you know, just about this early 1600s, when the East came West, when Europe came to America. So the armor that I wear is armor that would have been worn by the conquistadors, you know. I had that. I had the armor, but I didn't have the headdress. And I knew that I wanted this headdress to establish the hybridity of the Western Hemisphere, help me to do that. And so I knew where there were very fantastic headdresses in carnival all over the Caribbean, all over South America. And so I went online on YouTube, which at that time was still a very wonderful resource. And I looked at carnivals everywhere. And I made a video out of this process of searching and putting up, and I put up the most interesting of the videos that I found, and I just kept going. And then I went to the Brooklyn Carnival, and I had my team shoot there. That was the last part of actual looking for a headdress and what I shot. But then just before I finished, I actually found the headdress that I was looking for, and it was in a book by Isaac de Belisario, who was part of a very well-known Sephardic Jewish family that lived in Jamaica and had lived there for centuries. It was a Sephardic family that also was slave-owning and slave-trading. One of the younger sons of Isaac Belisario, he was an artist. And so he just was interested in things like, how does carnival look, you know? And so Belisario made a notebook of, they were lithographs, I think, but they had many different forms. And these, believe it or not, he made in 1832, which was just before slavery was outlawed in Jamaica. And within a year after slavery was outlawed, carnival was outlawed. And that's because carnival had always been a place where the slaves could use cynicism and irony to critique their masters. They were free on the 2 days of carnival to do that. So he had made these pictures of various figures in Junkanoo, which was the Jamaican carnival. And one of them was a figure called Actor Boy. And Actor Boy was one of the more professional of the figures in that carnival. And he was somebody who wore a dress, and always a male wearing a dress. And he had a tall, tall headdress that looked almost like a Christmas tree. And I said, that's what I'm going to use for my headdress for Lancela, Palm and Steel, I call her. And the adaptation that I made was pretty crude. I just put a literal palm tree on top of my helmet. And I don't know, I mean, I hope that it makes the point of these two cultures coming together in a way to represent the true nature of the Western Hemisphere.
I think you just keep on marching and you just have this steady beat of your preparation and your imagination. And I gather this outfit, this armor and the palm tree, that's going to be another performance. I know the photos that were at the Brooklyn Museum and they're on the cover of your catalog.
I called the exhibition at the Brooklyn Museum Both And, because I realized that, in fact, you know, sometimes you start doing this work and you think you know what you're doing, but you don't really. You're really finding out what you want to do as you do it. And it took me a little while to understand that I used the diptych in the very first work that I did, like Nefertiti Devonir Evangeline in 1980, but it probably wasn't until, you know, the 1990s that I began to theorize it more carefully. And I realized that the diptych was my weapon of choice in this fight that I was trying to wage, because I consider the biggest obstacles that we are facing to a world of equality is this sort of either-or philosophical underpinning of Western culture, that it's not culture and nature, it's culture or nature, culture better than nature. It's always hierarchical, it's always oppositional, and it's always not good and evil, it's good or evil, good better than evil. Not ever any recognition that all of these qualities, you know, like joy and anger to make the Mademoiselle Bourgeois performance, all of these qualities are intrinsic in all of us, and they are a part of a sort of a dance that we have to perform in order to remain fully human. And trying to eliminate one or the other, trying to be all good or, you know, all bad, you know, you're headed for trouble. And I feel that the best way for me to encapsulate my program, as it were, as an artist, was to start to foreground this both and anti-binaristic logic that I feel, because I feel that the binary and the either or is like, it's spreading inequalities wherever you go, you know, every area of life. And I think that white supremacy, for instance, is just only one of the inequalities that it fosters in Western culture.
Well, you have an amazing career. You've been on the internet from the get-go, I gather, and your website, to me, is extraordinary. And you told me that you designed it. It's totally your work. And
I feel like I was lucky. I happened to land at Harvard at the Bunting Institute in 1994, I think it was, or 95, which was the start of the internet. If you can believe it, my first browser was Netscape One. And from there, I'd been teaching at the School of Visual Arts for 25 years, and I went to teach at the University of California at Irvine. And I landed there in 2000, which was just exactly when all of the instruction was changing over from analog to digital. So we started the semester of the art history course that I was co-teaching using analog slides, and we ended the semester using digital PowerPoint. And so I was there always at the ground level of what the internet was, how it delivered information, what people needed to get from it in order to understand what was going on. And that was what really helped me make a very good website, I think.
I know that throughout your career, you've really connected to younger artists. And Sandra Perry is part of this series. And she was so lovely when she spoke. I asked her about you. And she said, oh, you occupy an integral position in her worldview. And I just thought that was so beautiful.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, I have to tell you that, you know, sometimes I don't know if it's that I connect to them or that they connect to me. You know, to be honest with you, I was not received very well by my peers when I was, you know, making this work. I mean, in the sense that, you know, not any specific peers, but just the cultural peerage of the art world was not that receptive. But since about 2010, I've been very aware that the changes in art education have finally begun to sort of pay off. You know, in academia, it can take 20 years for an idea to take hold, right? Because people have to unteach themselves as well as be taught. So I find that younger people, my biggest audience is under 30, it seems. But I myself, I don't know. I really do talk to young people as if I care about what they have to say. Do you know what I'm saying? I think that's probably it. I did a studio visit at Skowhegan with Sandra, and she was absolutely so highly developed that it was just a joy to be in her studio. And I'm glad she liked the experience, what can I say?
So I'm going to give you one last question, and it's something that I'm asking each of my guests. Given all of these ups and downs of the last 18 months and the kind of struggles that we've all faced in trying to adapt, how has technology affected you and your practice?
I had a very strange 18 months because I was probably doing what I would have had to have done anyway because I was having a retrospective. Whether or not there had been a lockdown, I would have had to have been chained to my computer, you know, working constantly, because I did not just the retrospective. I also was publishing a book of my collected writings, which was just published by Duke University, as it's called Writing in Space. So I was doing the both and catalog and both and exhibition, but at the same time, I was also doing Writing in Space, which was a book of collected writings. So I had no time. I was working 14, 16 hours a day at my computer. So I would have been doing that whether or not there had been a lockdown, I think. It wasn't until the lockdown was sort of slightly over. Remember in May when we kind of had this little reprise, we could all go out and have fun? That was when I realized how deprived I'd been, you know? I don't know. I'm facing my first real facing of lockdown as a really terrible deprivation, imposition, whatever have you. And I'm, you know, I'm just like everybody else. I'm starting to get like a little angry and annoyed, you know. But I hope that we can all keep good humor and, you know, get out of it alive. What could I say?
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed your book, the two books, the catalog and your selected writings and your exhibition. And I can't wait to see the next work. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me again. Thank you.
Support for Barbara London Calling 2.0 is generously provided by the Kramlich Art Foundation. The series is produced by Ryan Leahy and production assistant Vuk Vukovic. Be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you can keep up to date with new episodes in the series. Follow us on Instagram at Barbara London Calling and check out my website, barbaralondon.net, for transcripts and links to the works discussed. Special thanks to Lee Rinaldo for graciously providing our music and to Independent Curators International for their help with the series. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.